Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And hello, good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning, good morning. You can tell this is Peter because he's the deep-voiced one.
Could I mention, by the way, that your nickname, of course, being Rabbit, you just absolutely cooked one of those marvelous local rabbits with fresh rosemary still from the garden, red wine, garlic. It was wonderful.
And the best tip of all was from Michael Simon, from just a few weeks ago, from his cookbook, and he said, make it and then keep it till the next day.
Yes, which worked.
Which I did. And not only that, we kept some until the next day after that.
Lunch.
And the leftovers, we practically fought over them because it tasted so delicious.
It was great.
So we're into delicious food, of course, as we always are, and today is a heavily food-oriented program.
Right.
Starting out, however, with a... Has Lydia Bastianich been on our program more than any other person?
Maybe.
probably, but she's always up to something new, and we caught up with her on a visit to Pittsburgh, which was just a very special treat. And we talked to her about her new book and her new program, and then we had lunch. So here's Lydia Bastianich.
Lydia Bastianich is unquestionably the grand dame of Italian cuisine in America, and also, as I read this latest, her sixth cookbook, you're so well-connected still in Italy.
Yes, Lydia Cooks from the Heart of Italy is about 10 different regions of Italy.
Yes, it says a feast of 175 regional recipes. And this book, two things I noted. One is that you did it with your wonderful daughter, Tanya, and it's dedicated to your father. Could you explain something about the dedication?
Right. Well, I dedicated, the books are about my family, and my family are so instrumental in what I do. And so kind of each one is for one person, and this one is for my father. And I thanked him for having the courage, and, you know, I came here when I was 12, but my mother and my father were mature in their between 40s and 50s when they brought us here, and they did not speak the language, and it's all because they felt that their children needed an environment to grow properly as adults, an environment, because, as you know, and that, you know, we were caught behind the Iron Curtain,
right,
the part of Italy that was given to Yugoslavia. So therefore, it was quite difficult, and we escaped back to Italy and ultimately came here as immigrants. So, you know, I really thank.
And what a dream come true.
Let me say something. It's funny you should say that, Lydia, because one of the first memories that I have of watching television, and it wasn't even actually television, it was news at the movie theater, was all about what was going on in a place called Trieste.
There you go.
And it was a piece of, you know, for you it's a piece of living history. For me, I had no idea where Trieste was. I had no idea what they were fighting about.
Yeah, and I was part of that sort of discussion, and I was part of that human number that were kind of decided what life will they, where will they be put behind the Iron Curtain or be back in Italy, and yeah, but you've been there since, so you've known the place.
We have.
Oh, yes.
Trieste is a lovely city and a fascinating connection to the Austro-Hungarian Empire as well, but we don't need to go into that, because I'm sure you have some recipes that reflect that anyway.
Yeah, well, let's give the overall thing. First of all, I wanted to say I copied something you said out of the book, because it kind of sums up your attitude, your philosophy of food. You say, waste not, want not, and make it delicious. And that, to me, is your approach to food.
It is. I think also the whole concept of, it's not a novel concept, certainly I didn't invent it, but
no.
If you go back into the true cooking of Italy, and I would venture to say for most of the great cultures, if you go back to the true roots, it's this respect for our surrounding, for the products, the seasons, using everything, and certainly these regions that I have in this book reflect that, and the recipes are so exemplary, but they're delicious at the same time. You know, if I have a great dessert that I make in here, and again, I must tell you that these are not my inventions of recipes. These are all recipes from the Italian culture, which I modified to some extent. But one of those recipes that I am so, it was the chocolate bread parfait, and it is from Umbria. And what they do there is that they take old bread and they melt some chocolate on a double boiler and some espresso coffee that they have left over, and put some rum in there, and then dunk this kind of old bread, dried bread, until it really absorbs and becomes moist with this coffee chocolate rum liquid, and then it's layered in a parfait glass with whipped cream and toasted almonds, and you keep on layering it. And
beautiful.
It is so delicious, so straightforward, just simple bread and the recycling of it, making it into a grand dessert.
Well, you work your way north to south in Italy, identifying characteristics of the food of each region and also the character of the region. And then you highlight different producers, you explain the different types of personalities you've met, and then Tanya adds, and in fact, I mean, I know Italy pretty well, and she finds places that I've never even knew to look for.
Well, you know, this is her specialty. She is an art historian. You know, she has a PhD from Oxford in Renaissance art history. But exactly what you said, you know, I mean, to identify the great paintings, the great churches, the great antiquities, I think, you know, a guidebook will do that well.
But she has personal experiences with off the beaten track.
Exactly. Even some place where you have to go and knock on the door to get the keys, and
yes,
the little church opens up. And that sort of fits in the way where I travel. So I think we share that with the reader. And you know, Anne, I've gotten a lot of response. People are using this book and even my previous book, which is Lydia's Italy, which are
yes,
the other 10 regions, as somewhat a sensibility of where to travel off the beaten track in Italy.
Yeah, I was thinking to myself, how would I take this with me?
There you go.
Because, I mean, there are lots and lots of tips in here.
The answer is we'll just have to extract the pages for the particular region we go to, one region at a time, and then
right,
we can certainly make that work.
Now, you took some of the photos?
Yeah. I did. I took most of the photos, you know, except for the food. That's Christopher Hirschheimer.
Yeah.
The photo of the places and people, I took them. And you know
beautiful,
how it is.
Yeah.
Thank you. But you know, Anne, how it is when you travel, and Peter, you take a lot of the photographs, I know, is you catch a moment and it won't happen again. You need to capture it then.
Right then,
so
yeah.
You can't send a photographer after to capture it. So I got into a little bit. I had some instruction by a photographer on simple, just no artificial light, just regular light photograph, kind of pressing the shutter, and that's what I do, and it's turning out fine.
Well, I have that great picture that I sent you of the of your vineyard in Friuli.
That was a beautiful
with
picture.
With the snowy Dolomites in the background.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's in Cividale del Friuli, yeah, the
yes,
Bassianich Winery.
Now, you spend parts of this book on studying or focusing on regional cheeses. That's sort of expressive of the different regions, the cheeses, huh?
Well, I think cheese is such a base for the Italian cuisine, and it reflects the character of the land itself, topography, hence which animals, what kind of pastures, and hence which animals. You know, you go up to the north to Lombardy and Emilia-Romagna, great pastures, you know, cows, lots of big milk, so the Grana Padano, the Parmigiano
right,
Reggiano, or Taleggio, all of those cheeses are made there. You begin to go south, the Apennines, the sort of the backbone of Italy is the chain of the Apennines, and there are, of course, a lot of goats and sheep and pigs, for that matter, so that the cheese reflects a lot of that pecorino cheese in all different, you know, in its young stage, the ricotta from sheep's milk, and those are the things that surface in the that they use in their recipes because it is a product that they have. So you can't separate the two.
Now, I made a couple, scribbled a few notes here. Is it true that Queen Elizabeth, the Queen of England, imports Calabrian onions?
She does. She does. The Cipolle di Tropea. These are wonderful. They look like, you know, kind of elongated, you know, like the shallots, but much bigger.
I don't think I've ever had one, knowingly, at least.
I remember reading about them because we started to study Calabria a little bit because we were thinking of going there, and we'll get there one of these years. And I remember Tropea as a town also that was a place I thought we would go when we were in the region.
Uh-huh. Well, Tropea is a beautiful town. Saint-Tropez up in the French Riviera, but this is maybe the Saint-Tropez of the south, the Tropea.
Uh-huh.
A lot of Italians go there. It's not yet very touristy known. And around Tropea, which is down on the Tyrrhenian Sea, and if you go around the tip of Calabria, you end up in the Ionian Sea. Well, there's a lot of great, great sandy beaches. Beautiful.
We saw some of those when we were in Puglia and Basilicata.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I think there's still so much to be discovered in Italy,
You've covered a lot of it, though, Lydia. I mean,
but Anne, every time I go, I find so many new things, and I said, boy, is there more to find out in this little country? I mean, it's just so rich of...
Well, you have really little-known recipes, too. I mean, rice and chestnuts I've never heard of.
Oh, it's great. You see, we used to eat as that's more of a Nordic, it's up in Piemonte, Trentino.
I see.
And we used to eat, you know, rice was a base for a lot of, a lot of cooking. I mean, rice cooked in milk, and inside, you know, if you put the chestnuts, or we put sometimes dried prunes. I mean, you know, that's what my grandmother and mother made, and that was sometimes the meal for us kids.
Well, yeah, I haven't, I guess we had a lot of chestnuts, but I don't recall mixing them with rice at all.
Well, it's delicious. Try it.
And then I'm assuming this cookbook that this is the ultimate osso buco recipe, right?
It is. It is. To talk about Lombardy and not to talk about osso buco and risotto milanese. And I always get asked for that. You know, Lydia can... But this is, I found, to be quite traditional, and I love it, and it really delivers a great osso buco.
And you also talk about no-stir risottos. Now, that's something I would look into.
Well, I think that I've been predicating about making the real risotto. So I think Americans got that. They're getting it. They know what the risotto is and whatever. They're getting familiar with the short grain rice. Now, I know that at home, my mother and my grandmother didn't always stir that risotto continuously. There were other ways of cooking the rice. Do you get 100% the creaminess that you do in a traditional technique of risotto? No. But it's a great, great alternative, especially, you know, you have a family to feed and you want to run around and do other things, but you want that kind of comfy risotto-like plate for the table. I have several different combinations.
Yeah, I know somebody who actually is an Italian wine merchant whose wife makes risotto, and she switched to a pressure cooker risotto. And I tried it once, and then I gave away the pressure cooker.
Well, no, because, you know, you need to mix it to some extent. Otherwise, you know, you want to sort of, in cooking risotto or the like, you want the starches to seep out from the rice and make the texture creamy. In a pressure cooker, I think it would leave, just doesn't have a chance to move, and the starch remains in the kernel.
Now, you talked about Moreno Cedroni. Isn't he a character?
Have you been? Have you visited with him?
Yes.
We have indeed. We interviewed. I don't know what time. He was involved in a
beauty pageant.
He was involved in a fundraising project in Rimini.
Oh,
and
okay.
He was arriving at any moment for about 3 hours.
Yeah. Oh yeah. He is. Well, that's not so uncommon for Italy. But, you know, because also they drive there, sometimes they get caught. But I think, you know, what he does, and this is in Le Marche, on the Adriatic coast of Italy, areas that are not very well known. But they have some great fish culture there. And, of course, he began this whole crudo movement
right.
in Italy.
All the regions of Italy, the one that most surprised me for its food culture was Le Marche.
Ah.
I really was surprised.
I guess our expectations were not all that great, although we did a lot of research ahead of time, and we were absolutely amazed.
It's so diversified because, again, it's a region that kind of sort of crawls up the Apennine, the mountains. So you have that whole mountainous, hearty food, you know, and game and boar. And then it sort of slides into the plain, right into the ocean. And you have this great, great seafood cuisine there that many people don't know.
Right. Now, which area surprised you the most? You seemed enthralled with Sardinia.
Sardinia was, I mean, I always loved it. You know what I loved about Sardinia was, how you can really see the cultures and the different occupation that went through there, and how the Spanish influence there is so tremendous. Mm-hmm. You know, besides having dishes a la catalana, in Alghero, they still speak Catalanian
right.
dialect. Actually, there are some academics from Spain studying the Catalan dialect in Alghero, mind you. But the paella, they still make paella there. So you know how, I mean, it's just so exemplified, even the architecture of the buildings and all of that, and I love that. And I love also, you know what I love? I love the nature, the formation of rocks
oh,
in Sardinia.
Yeah. It's like sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
And there, did you read that book, that the Sardinian who has two restaurants in Texas?
No.
It's interesting. You got a lot of background in the cultures. He grew up there.
Uh-huh.
And then we met a Sardinian chef with a restaurateur in Australia.
Just outside Sydney. In fact, we put those two gentlemen in touch with one another.
It's unusual.
The most interesting thing I can remember is that the chef in Australia, I've forgotten his name now, I was trying to remember it the other day, he discovered an ex-Sardinian who was making Bottarga in northern Queensland. And he said, I think it's a better product than the one I get from Sardinia, so it's what I use all the time.
Oh, that's nice. You see, good old traditions, they die hard.
Well, Lydia, now, is this already a PBS program?
Yes.
Okay.
There's 52 half-hour episodes that are parallel and that reflect all of these things that I talk about and the recipes in this new book, Lydia Cooks from the Heart of Italy.
Well, listeners, tune in because you get to watch Lydia too, and she just glows.
Yeah.
Lydia, thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks, Anne. Thanks, Peter.
Well,
okay.
I want to have our listeners eat their hearts out as I say that the next thing we're going to do after I save this interview is we're going to come down to Lydia's for lunch. So we'll see you in a few minutes.
Okay, I'm waiting for you.
Ciao, Lydia.
Ciao.
Well, she is just one great lady, and she just lifts your spirits whenever you talk to her. She's always up. And we had a wonderful lunch, did we not?
We did. It took much longer than expected, which is appropriate for an Italian lunch, and we're going to have some more of them coming up very soon, so that's always not fun. But let's not forget that it's time to take a
break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Thank you for keeping us up to snuff in terms of what's going on in the world of food. Anyone who wants to do us, give us tips, info, you can email us. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, any way you can think of. And we love this being connected. Now, next up, we have somebody who's been connected for quite a long time and also very much into the family. And his name is Mark Peel, renowned chef. And
yep, at Family Dinners was a special event at his restaurant
right.
called Campanile in Los Angeles.
Right.
We actually met him, if you remember, at Five Star Sensation but in Cleveland just a few months ago.
Right.
But sure enough, shortly on the heels of that, he came out with
a
cookbook based on a very special approach to putting dishes on the menu at Campanile, which he'll, of course, explain. And then they explain how you can create these dishes for yourself in this cookbook.
Mark Peel, we have now a new book out by you. Let's say that you are a highly awarded chef and the chef owner of Campanile Restaurant in California.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not by any means your first book, but it's one close to your heart. It's
very
called
my heart.
Yeah, it's called New Classic Family Dinners.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter, you had a question.
Well, I have an observation, which I wish you'd explain, because you mentioned in the book about the whole idea of recreating dishes that were longtime favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll have you explain why you decided to put these on the menu on Monday nights at Campanile, because I think that's interesting. The piece I thought was the most revealing in your introduction was that you compared what it's like for a chef to be cooking in his kitchen at the restaurant and then to be cooking at home.
Oh, I... don't remember that one. I could turn to it and try to figure that out. But I do know this in general. Cooking in the restaurant is in many ways much easier than cooking at home. Because at home, you don't have a dishwasher, you don't have a prep cook, you don't have a sous chef. You can't say, just turn to someone and say, hand me the cheese.
Yeah.
You do it all yourself. Professional chef faces every single obstacle that the regular home cook faces.
No, that's exactly what you said in the book. You said I probably don't ever finish a whole dish.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly make a whole lot of mess.
Mm-hmm.
And I related to that because I cook at home and I get reprimanded for making a terrible mess. So now I clean up as I go along. I was used to think it was a triumph to get the food on the table.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize along the way you were also supposed to be tidy.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true.
No.
I have had to retrain myself as well. At home, to clean as I go, exactly as you say.
But
you tested all these things, all your recipes were tested on home equipment, right?
Yes, but not by me. And I think that that's an important point, because it wouldn't have worked as well if I had done all the testing. Because as a professional chef, you make these kind of mental leaps unconsciously. You fix things as you go,
so
without thinking about it. So,
so who did you get to
collaborator, Martha... Martha Schulman.
Okay, great.
Is not a professional chef, but she is a wonderful cookbook author, and she has a decent kitchen at home. Nothing spectacular, an old Wedgwood stove, and she made everything at home. And we corrected them when we came across mistakes, and we came across plenty of mistakes.
Now, you have a set of equipment that you consider essential to be able to go about doing these recipes and really doing anything approaching professional at home.
Well, I'm not trying to make people into professional chefs at home.
Uh-huh.
All these recipes were designed specifically so that people can make them at home. There's nothing unusual. There's no stock called for. Chicken broth is fine, canned chicken broth.
Yeah.
The equipment is simple, knives. The most exotic piece of cooking equipment I call for is a food mill or a mortar and pestle.
Oh, well, that's, I mean, we've had food mills.
Mm-hmm.
In fact,
I think they're great.
Yeah, I mean, I discovered that we still had one, and I don't use it, but I know we have one. And shoot off.
It requires no electricity.
Yeah, it's good.
It works easy. It works very well. Yeah, they're easy to clean.
Yeah.
You've got a couple of things in there. You've got a couple of things in there, Mark. Let's admit, you say you must have a weigh scale, and you need things like a microplane. And
well, you need a microplane, but that's a grater.
That's what we have.
The microplane is essential. You can use a grater. Scale is important. But I think mostly it's important in baking, in dessert making.
Right.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I've never operated with one, but I don't bake, but I still think it's absolutely essential. I've talked to enough pastry chefs to know that.
But anyway, let's pop back to the aegis of the idea for this, if you like, branch of American cuisine that you popularized at Campanile. Go ahead and explain how it came to be.
Well, there are all these old recipes, all these old dishes that have fallen off menus, fallen off the radar. Things like lobster Newberg, things like veal piccata, tuna noodle casserole. I'm going to thumb through.
We're actually at the stage of the summer. We're going to make this
Santa
one.
Santa Maria barbecue, vitello tonnato.
Yeah, we made all those.
It's easy to make. Sausages braised in beer with sauerkraut. Sole meuniere. Chicken a la king.
Chicken a la king. It's amazing, isn't it? The
chicken a la king. I loved that when I first heard the word, the term when I was little. I thought it was chicken Allen King.
There you go.
Great! I love Allen King.
But these are, all of us of a certain age grew up with these things.
Right, and then they were overdone and badly done and poor renditions and they fell out of favor. But in the beginning, they were very, very good. Things don't become extremely popular because they're bad.
Now, that intersected
with... There's a great appeal to them. And people, when they read these recipes, they already understand a little bit about where we're going with them.
But that
so that makes it much easier to cook.
But that intersected with what was happening in your restaurant as well. Because Campanile is a contemporary fine dining restaurant, except on Monday.
Well, except on Mondays. And the family dinners on Mondays, it's not the only menu we offer. We also offer the regular menu. But this is the most popular thing, is the family dinner. It comes family style. It's inexpensive. There's three courses, plus coffee or tea. We're always working a theme. Very convivial.
Sounds like fun, huh?
Fried chicken. Good old southern fried chicken done the right way. Marinated overnight in buttermilk. cooked in a cast iron skillet with real pork lard. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, but it's been in the news.
Yeah,
it's very much in the news now. All the chefs are rediscovering a southern fried chicken.
And lard. You know what? Lard got a bad reputation.
Yeah.
It makes the best pie crust, and it makes the best fried chicken. And it's no more unhealthy for you than butter is.
Yeah. Is it the same as beef tallow for French fries? You can't beat that either.
Mm-hmm. Which is what we use for French fries on Thursday nights when we do grilled cheese night.
Oh, you have a grilled cheese night, too.
Mm-hmm.
We had that one wonderful book. Who wrote that book about grilled cheese sandwiches?
I think that was my ex-wife.
That's right. I didn't do that on purpose, Mark.
Excuse me.
No. I'm glad you remember.
I'm not sure.
She was the one who started grilled cheese at Campanile. Continue it on.
There's a more recent book, and it's not by Nancy Silverton, so I can't remember who it is.
Well,
there have been several books written about grilled cheese.
Anyhow, it was pretty good. It was really, you could do wonders with grilled cheese sandwiches.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what did you do? You say that these dishes were popular, but then they were overdone and abused.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go about correcting it and bringing them back to their prime again?
Well, the two things that I offer, I think, as the best example is macaroni and cheese, which is still popular, but the terrible, terrible rendition that Kraft does. True macaroni and cheese does not consist of mushy noodles folded with a mushy iridescent sauce. A real macaroni and cheese is a great casserole with very good cheese, a mixture of cheeses, cheddars, we use mozzarella, the fresh mozzarella, parmesan. We put in some reconstituted dried mushrooms, and it gets a crust, a little breadcrumb crust. So you have the contrast between the soft, unctuous, very aromatic inside and the crispness on the top and that kind of caramelized, crisp edge around the outside. That's what a real macaroni and cheese is.
Do you put tomato in yours?
No. In macaroni and cheese, no. I would disagree with that. I think that if you add tomato, you would add too much water.
Water, I think so. I think that's what I disliked about it growing up. These aren't
and
all
the other is chicken pot pie.
Chicken pot. And everybody loves that.
Swanson did a terrible job to chicken pot pie. A really good chicken pot pie is basically, it's like chicken a la king. In a pie crust. I didn't even bother to put in a puff pastry recipe because Pepperidge Farm does a very decent job of making puff pastry. frozen section if ever in supermarket. I'm not opposed to corporations just because they're corporations. Pepperidge Farm makes a very decent puff pastry.
But Kraft makes awful macaroni.
Kraft makes awful macaroni and cheese, and Swanson makes awful pot pies.
There you go. Now, while we have you on the phone, we must give you the opportunity also to talk about the things that you're doing with Campanile on other nights of the week as well.
Well, that's family dinner on Monday. On Thursday, it's grilled cheese night, panini night, really, because some of them don't involve cheese at all. They're open-faced. And then on Fridays, we're doing Friday night flights. It's three small dishes paired with three glasses of wine. And it all comes at the same time. The idea is that there's no perfect pairing between a particular food and a particular wine. So it's great if you can try everything all at the same time. You know, mathematically, you have nine combinations, not instead of three.
There you go. And you still might invent something for Wednesdays, I guess, too.
We might. Well, actually, we do a very simple menu on Wednesdays. We started off during the writer's strike. We were doing on Wednesdays a writer's soup kitchen, a simple menu for $22. Soup is the first course, a simple main course, and then cookies and ice cream for dessert.
Now, did you have to be a Hollywood writer to get it?
We told people we were going to check for union cards, but we never did, not even once.
Now, Campanile is in Los Angeles, but put a dot on the map. So Los Angeles is such a big place.
Oh, we're on La Brea, just north of Wilshire Boulevard.
Okay, so you're not...
Midtown.
Not downtown, but not too far away.
Not too far away. Miracle Mile, Hancock Park, that area.
Now, I might say that there's one thing else about this book that's very handy, is you're tied to the seasons and the way we all used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I noticed that Peter had marked here, that we're about ready to do, because we're a garden's winding down in southwestern Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. is green tomato soup with bacon. Now, that just fits all the niches that we have,
mm-hmm.
as even a current trend. I didn't know it was an old recipe, but it's something we certainly need a recipe for that.
Well, it's a variation on an old recipe, on a tomato soup. And there's a, you know, if you look, there's a green tomato salad as well. A mixed green and red tomatoes with a little bit of Russian dressing.
Oh, my.
It's phenomenal. Uh-oh. The green tomatoes have a sharpness, acidity, you know, they're piquant, they're pungent, and then you have the sweetness of the red tomatoes kind of matched together.
Wow.
And then the green tomato soup, again, it's got a nice sharpness to it that is kind of modified and mellowed by the bacon.
You know what? I think you're really in love with the recipes in this book rather than the more modern ones.
I am. And I love it because I love it showing people the recipes because people really can do these.
Oh. Well, you should get together with that woman that wrote the classic desserts, Rediscovered. Did you? The Lost Desserts book?
No, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, it's called Lost Desserts, and she goes back and rethinks all the desserts that used to be in favor that nobody sees anymore.
Yeah, when I can remember
Baked
is,
Alaska.
When I can remember is Charlotte Russe.
Charlotte Russe.
Which I think my mother or my Aunt Margaret used to make Charlotte Russe. It always seemed like such a strange name for a dish. And she went, whoever it was, she went back to discover the authentic contents of all of these desserts,
mm-hmm.
some of which had been totally lost. She had to do primary research because no one could actually find a trace of the ingredients, and she had to piece it together.
So I don't know what Charlotte Russe is, except it's Russian. And it's a Charlotte, which is kind of a custardy.
Yeah, it's a custardy. It's a custardy thing with a fruit in it. Now, what the Charlotte part of it is, I'm not sure. I mean, I've heard of apple Charlotte,
mm-hmm.
so it's a variation on that, and I can't remember what makes
that
particular variant.
Well, I think it's just
variant.
A custardy mold.
It is a mold, yeah.
And then you can put almost any kind of fruit you have into
mm-hmm.
it.
Well, Mark, let me repeat the name of this book again. Very approachable, very useful, and inspiring, actually, in terms of the quality of something that you can make. You cooks there, you could make at home. New Classic Family Dinners, and it's Mark Peel. And I think that it's the kind of thing that you should have in your closet. Now we're all back home cooking.
Absolutely. You can cook them at home, so.
I'm going to do something special for Mark in just a second. I don't have the information to hand yet because I have to look it up on the internet. But there is an interview with Mark Peel on the menu at Five Star Sensation in Cleveland earlier this year. And if you go to OTM Audio Archives listeners, you can find out what was up that particular evening. And Mark, before you sign off, I'll give you the date so you can listen to it yourself.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Mark.
Well, thank you for having me.
Bye.
It was a privilege.
Oh, thank you. Bye. And with that, now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and this is last episode of the program segment, I guess we call it.
This is an interesting segment.
It certainly is.
It's the 21st century equivalent of the range wars between the proponents of certified Angus, corn-finished, if not corn-fed beef, on the one hand, and on the other hand,
the purest grass-fed.
Purest grass-fed beef, and more of the science of meat than meets the eye, and a fascinating spokesperson called John Wood, who talked about a lifetime of raising cattle and then a decade or so of getting the grass-fed gospel, I guess.
Gospel. And gospel's a good word.
And becoming its disciple, not disciple, what's the right word? Spokesperson? I'm thinking of the religious term for that.
Prophet, no.
Prophet, yeah, there you go. The prophet of grass-fed beef. Yeah, you'll certainly believe that. And
anyhow, they're interesting conversations, and
we decided
you'll learn something.
Yeah, we decided there was no way out of it. We had to put them together, and we flipped a coin as to who went first. So I'm sure you'll be very interested by the final segment. It may change the way you think about America's favorite meat.
We're having a really big beef moment, it seems. We are comparing different kinds of beef and different ways of cooking it. And to help us with our exploration, today we have Chef Scott Popovic, and he's from the Certified Angus Beef, is it Council, Scott?
Certified Angus Beef brand, actually.
Brand, okay. So it is a brand. You'll tell us about that in a minute.
Yeah.
And from a Giant Eagle, our main, in the Pittsburgh area, shopping supermarket, we have Chef Carla with a K, Contreras. Welcome, both of you, to On the Menu.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you.
How about starting, Scott, with the definition of certified Angus beef?
Well, certified Angus beef is a brand of beef which represents the top 8% of all the beef available in the United States. Really, it's about the 10 science-based specifications that really narrow it down to give you the best flavor and the best consistency out there.
Now, when you use the word Angus, but this actually applies to all the breeds that make beef, like Herefords and...
Angus, certified Angus beef represents just Angus cattle.
Okay, so it is just the Angus cattle.
Just the Angus cattle. So it's got to be at least 51% black-hided to make our brand. So it's got to have those Angus genetics because we know that the Angus breed of cattle tends to marble. And marbling is really what gives beef its great flavor.
We interviewed somebody who raised Wagyu beef, and he said that what they had to do was they would breed the Wagyu, but then they would implant the embryos into Angus cows.
Yeah.
Because the Wagyus were nasty mothers, but the Wagyus were wonderful mothers. I mean, the Angus were wonderful mothers.
Yes.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, you know, when you're breeding, like, Wagyu cattle, Wagyu, American Kobe, when you look at Kobe in the United States, the Wagyu cattle tend to marble, but it takes a long time for them to marble. So when you're looking at the cattle that produce Kobe or American Kobe, you tend to get older cattle, so it's generally not rated through the USDA because of that.
Well, he's a man who knows everything, huh?
You know everything.
I have a question I want to ask you later on, but let's stay on theme for the time being.
Okay, our next thing is, because we wanted to do a comparison of Angus are generally grain-fed as opposed to grass-fed, which is the hot new trend, right?
Well, certified Angus beef is a brand of beef. We work with every segment of the industry, including the seed stock producers, the ranchers, the packing plants, and even restaurateurs. When you're talking about traditional raised cattle, it's cattle that are raised on grass-fed pretty much their entire lives, up until about the last 100 days. 100 to 120 days, that's when they go into a feedlot. And the feedlot actually gives them a high grain ration diet. So it's that grain ration diet that really gives beef its marbling.
Okay, but you mean you really let them graze up until that late?
Yeah, really, up until about the last 100 days. And then they're taken to a feedlot, and those feedlots feed them grain and high rationed diets that help that produce that fat, that marbling.
Now, are they happy?
Are they happy? Yes, they're really happy. I actually was just out in Colorado at a feedlot, and they are extremely happy. They're just eating away. It's kind of like a big buffet for them. Really.
Now, but you're in Cleveland. How does that work?
Well, I travel around a lot for my job.
I bet, yeah. Now, Carla, you handled this at the Giant Eagle. Giant Eagle's making an incredible splash right now, isn't it?
I know. Market District by Giant Eagle right now is opening a third store, which is going to be magnificent. It's going to be great. I invite everybody to stop by and see it. We are up in Settles Ridge in Robinson Township, and today is one of the big opening days. Scott is actually going to be doing a great demo on Sunday. Everybody's welcome to stop by and see him. And, of course, he's going to join me tomorrow, Saturday, at a demonstration here at the Market District in Shadyside.
Oh, great. So you'll be in our neighborhood tomorrow and then back out to Settlers Creek to the new store on Sunday?
Yes, just doing some cooking.
And what are you going to be fixing, guys? Let's give us an idea of what you think really shows.
I'm actually, because one of the things that I find to be very popular right now is crock pot cookery. So I'm going to be going over a little bit with a crock pot, so doing a pot roast, and then taking the leftovers from that pot roast and making an omelet out of it. So something that you normally wouldn't think of, but, you know, things that you can do with your leftovers.
Now, but isn't it pricey? I mean, Angus beef?
Well, certified Angus beef has a slight premium, but, again, you're getting a consistent, high-quality product.
Now, so you can get cheaper cuts, too?
No, let's... Well,
how about the flat iron steak? Why don't you talk a little bit about that? It's my personal favorite, and I talk to my customers at the store about certified Angus beef, and especially about the flat iron steak, which is great.
Yes, that's fabulous, right?
Yeah, you pay a slight premium and with the brand, but you get a high quality product. You can get more, you know, less expensive cuts, such as the flat iron or the flank steak, that perform phenomenally for a minimal amount. And it's great for the family and very great flavor.
Now, we had a hanger steak last night, but the last couple of times before that we did beef, we had skirt steak, and we really liked the skirt steak. We thought that was so flavorful.
Yeah, I actually love the inside skirt, so it's just got a great flavor. And take it, you shave it off a little bit, a little empanadas or taquitos, and you're good to go.
Now, clarify for us, if you would, the difference between USDA Choice and Prime. I always get confused, and that is presumably applies to certified Angus beef just like anything else.
Well, yes. When you're talking grades by the USDA, it's graded. The product is graded by the USDA between the 12th and 13th rib of the animal, and they look predominantly at marbling. So that's a marbling score. It's how much marbling is in that ribeye. So Prime has more marbling than Choice. Now, certified Angus beef is a brand that gets graded by the USDA, and it has to meet 10 science-based specifications, one of them being marbling. In fact, the most important one being marbling.
So what's happening is your certified Angus will almost always be Choice?
We actually offer certified Angus beef, traditional, which is Choice, and we offer a certified Angus beef Prime, which is USDA Prime, plus the specifications to make the certified Angus beef brand. Plus, we also offer a certified Angus beef natural, which is a never, never, never program. So it's never given hormones, never given antibiotics, and it's always traceable to birthplace of origin. So it's exactly what you and I as consumers think of a natural product.
How did you get a brand name from something that's actually a piece of livestock?
Well, to really go back to the beginning, we were started 30 years ago by an Angus producer in Ohio. When we were started, there was no other brand of beef. All there was USDA, Choice, Select, Good, and Prime. So when we started, there was no other brand out there, and we were started by an Angus producer. So what he knew of was Angus genetics. In fact, we're actually a non-profit organization, in marketing and educational arm of the American Angus Association.
Oh, yeah, and which is Scottish, right?
Yeah, well, now let's put in a plug for the fact that the Angus cattle originally came from Scotland, and they sure are as black as the ace of spades, as they say.
Yes.
And they were recognized in my native land as being, clearly the superior breed for producing beef, and I guess American producers caught on to that too, right?
Well, back in the early 70s, there was a lot of things going on. There was a wide influx of different breeds of cattle in the U.S. There was the change of the USDA grading specifications, and the terminology war on fat came into play in the middle of the 70s, Angus genetics in the cattle herd went down. And that's one of the reasons why we were started, was to give a consistent, high-quality product to the consumer and to help increase the demand for Angus genetics.
So that's how you got to be a non-profit.
So there was actually less Angus beef rather than more, and now you've changed it around, I guess.
Yes, we started to change it around.
You're breeding,
and
right?
Why you see Angus everywhere nowadays.
Well, it's people making a choice.
On Hardee's menus, McDonald's menus,
yes, right.
Cheesecake Factory, you see Angus at Giant Eagle.
Yeah, now, Carla, tell us what you do at Giant Eagle. Are you, like, in the meat department, or what exactly does the chef do there?
Actually, I'm on-site chef, and what I do is I, using our ingredients throughout the whole store, I develop recipes so our customers can taste them. And, of course, if they like it, they're going to take the recipe home with them, and they're going to make them at home. Doing a great job here working with the 35 Angus beef, of course, I expose the customers to different cuts, and I give them advice on how to season them. Instead of making the old traditional pot roast, we play around with flavors such as pomegranate, figs, apricots, just to spice it up. And then people get more excited about trying new things and getting them our stores, of course.
Well, do you feel jealous not being at Robinson Town Center? That place is going to be put Giant Eagle on an international map.
I know, but you know what? To be honest, I don't. I think it's going to be a little bit crazy, and I love my customers here at Shadyside.
Uh-huh.
However, I will be traveling on a regular basis to the new store as well to do some classes with my fellow chefs.
Yeah, there's a cooking school there too, right?
Yes, I will be doing classes there as well.
Well, it would be easier asking what's not going to be there, because I got the whole brochure. I couldn't believe it.
I know.
A charcuterie,
fantastic
place, a pizzeria, a bake shop.
A gelato bar as well. I'm excited about that one.
A what?
Gelato bar.
Oh, yeah, gelato bar. I forgot about that one.
Well, you got to have some gelato. After you had your certified Angus, you have to have some gelato, right?
Of course, to wash it down.
Well, thanks, Scott and Carla, for explaining to us the issue of the beef.
Yes.
Thank you.
It's hard sometimes to keep it all straight.
Yes.
So, is there anything else we should tell anybody?
Well,
how about do you have a website for the certified Angus beef?
Yeah.
Scott?
For more information and any type of recipe information or just information about the breed or the brand of certified Angus beef, you can go to our website, CertifiedAngusBeef.com.
I have one more question.
Alrighty.
And a funny thing happened. We were just in Spain.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And
yes.
We were at a small village restaurant with someone from a winery, a bodega that we had just visited. And they had a very interesting menu, but the two beef dishes on the menu, they made it clear that the meat came from a cow, not a bull. And I said, you know, that's very unusual in the United States. You really don't hear about that because all cows are kept because they're valuable for breeding.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked the owner of the restaurant why he said this is cow beef, and he said, because it's much tenderer. And I want my customers to know that it's the tenderest cut they're getting. Now, is there anything to that?
Honestly, I'm not sure. I would have to go back to our PhD meat scientist on staff to find out the science behind it.
Well, I tell you what, I'd be interested in finding out some more about that. So if you have a chance to do that, and then just send us an email to onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com.
Definitely.
And we'll let our listeners know whether it's fact or fiction.
Definitely. I will definitely have somebody look into that.
Yeah, it's been bothering Peter since he heard about
it was really confusing.
Killing all the mothers.
That was really confusing because I thought, well, about the only cow that's going to make it into the packing plant is a cow that's really old.
Right.
You certainly might not want to eat one of those ones they call stumblers.
Oh, dear.
and that's not really what you would want at all. So I think it's a very...
let us know, Scott.
Yeah, let us
great
know. And we'll,
I'm definitely going to find out the answer on that one.
Great. Thank you so much.
Carla, say hello to all of our buddies at Giant Eagle.
Okay. I will do.
Judy Dodd, be sure to tell her I said hello.
Yeah, I was at Giant Eagle. I was at Giant Eagle this morning, but I bought turkey today.
Good choice, too.
Yes.
Okay. All right, you guys.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you
very much.
And continue having fun.
Always.
Well.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, we have this very shy person on the line. His name is John Wood, and he's a fifth-generation farmer and a whole bunch else. He is talking to us about grass-fed beef and about uswellnessmeats.com. Welcome, John.
Well, Ann, I'm honored and pleased to be on your show.
Why don't you run through your list of, what do we call them? qualifications, experiences, definition of who you are?
Well, I guess the short version is I'm a fifth-generation farmer. My family roots go back into northeast Missouri, back to 1848, when my great-great grandparents moved in here from Kentucky, and they were pioneers in every sense of the word. And my ancestry on both sides of the family had a pretty significant pioneering streak to them, adventure streak, not afraid of anything new streak, and apparently that carried into my background because I was pretty much a conventional farmer. I graduated from college in 1975 from Iowa State University, and then I got into a commercial, large commercial family farm, which was typical in northeast Missouri. We produced corn and soybeans and wheat, and we produced cattle, backgrounded cattle, and we fed them grain. And then I took a turn in my course of direction in the mid to early 1990s. I stumbled into some research on grass-fed beef, was quite intrigued with it, and realized not many people knew about this, and one thing led to the other. In 1997, we experimented with the first grass-fed beef animal, and being from the Show-Me State, we were quite shocked. Three of the founding members sat around a barbecue grill one night, and we compared grass-fed beef to a piece of prime Hereford beef, which was extremely well over prime. I mean, it had been gourmet restaurant quality. We all three preferred the flavor of the grass-fed beef. We couldn't figure out why, and we cut it with a plastic knife and a fork, and we concluded it would never happen again, that this was an absolute fluke and it was just dumb luck, and we just wrote it off as a very unusual experiment. But we did it again in 1998. We had the same experience, and that really dumbfounded us because we just couldn't believe it could happen 2 years in a row, and that started to cause some questions to be raised. Well, how can this be? Because it was against everything we've been taught. We've been taught to believe you had to feed animals corn in order to get the marbling in to make them tender and make them taste proper.
Now, when did they start feeding them corn, which they were not designed by nature to eat?
That's very, very good. And these animals, primarily in the United States and in the world, up until 1960, pretty much all the beef raised in this country and in the world itself was grass-fed beef. In fact, even today, 70% of the world consumes grass-fed beef. And after World War II, we had a surplus of nitrogen, a fertilizer, which was also bomb-making material, and the government decided they could put it out on cropland to increase corn yields. Not only did they increase corn yields, they doubled corn yields in 1946, 47, 48, and so all of a sudden the farmers are crying because they had this huge lot of corn and didn't know what they're going to do with all this excess corn they had stored. So Land-Grant University decided they could feed it to cattle because cattle will eat between 22 and 25 pounds of corn a day, which corn is very heavy in starch. And what happens, you take a grazing animal driving down the highway. If you observe a cow out there in the pasture, she's got four stomachs. And the first stomach is the rumen or the fermentation vat, followed by the reticulum, abomasum, and small intestine. And that fermentation vat is all driven by billions of bacteria, and that sets the pH. And the pH in the grazing animal, in real simple terms, is pH 7. And from those of you in your chemistry days, it's a neutral pH. And the same animal, if you take it into a commercial feedlot, get it up on a full feed of corn, consuming 22, 23, 24 pounds of corn a day, the pH drops all the way back to 4.5. Well, guess what? The bacteria at pH 7, they all perish, and you have an entirely new family develop at pH 4.5. And that completely changes the lipid profile of the finished product. The omega-3s drop out as compared to the grazing animal. The omega-6s go up dramatically, and the CLA, conjugated linoleic acid, which is a very, very neat compound that the grazing animals produce. And this is number one cancer-fighting property in food world today is grass-fed beef, and CLA is actually slows the onset of cancer, slows cancer tumors. And this was discovered in the mid-80s by Dr. Mike Parisa, who's still on staff at the University of Wisconsin. And he was doing work about charcoal broiling beef. And I'm old enough to remember the 1970s, and there was news claims that that was going to cause cancer. And he discovered there was a compound within red meat, that was actually impeding the growth of the tumors he was trying to seed. And another year and a half later, he discovered these double-bonded carbon chains called conjugated linoleic acid. And that was really what got his imagination. And they also determined, by the way, that charcoal broiling was not as near the health issues that people thought. So that led to another whole round of research on CLA, which is still going on today. A lot of animal studies have been done. And very interestingly, there was a swine study down at Iowa State University in the winter of 1999 and 2000. The pigs on a diet of hydrogenated safflower oil, which is kind of a commercially available source of CLA, not economically feasible in commercial animal operations, but they discovered that these pigs had 25% less back fat and a 10% larger loin eye. Well, we have a number of figure fitness models and female bodybuilders and male bodybuilders that buy grass-fed beef from us because they're after the CLA because it buffs their bodies and reduces fat and puts on the muscle.
Hold on a second, Jim. let's not turn this into too much of a chemistry lesson. I think if I were to summarize what you said, it appears that there's been a several decade-long conspiracy to make sure that Americans are convinced that the only good beef to eat is corn-fed or corn-finished beef, and in fact the chemistry says that's totally false. Did I summarize it nicely there?
That's a real short, sweet point to it, and we've been led to believe that the feeding grain is going to increase the taste and the flavor. But here's really what happened. What we're doing today in the grass-fed program is much different than our forefathers did before the last 15 years came along. If all of your listeners could look at the floor, you know, they're listening or their car, their floor of their car, or the floor of their home or their office, and just imagine that was broken up into 30 pieces, and that represents one day of the month, or 31 pieces. The animals start on square one on the first day of the month, and at 4 o'clock they move to square two the following day. And the reason we do it late in the afternoon is the sugars are highest in the plants when the sun's been out for, you know, 8 or 10 hours. And as we rotate around these pastures, these animals get very smart. They know at 4 o'clock there's ice cream and cookies available, and they line up and they hear you coming on your little four-wheeler. They wait till you open the gate, and then they come, and they're in the best grass that you can put them into. And this happens on a daily basis. And the reason that this meat tastes better is because we keep these animals on a high plane of nutrition due to this managed intensive grazing. And this is a technique that's been developed in the last 25 years, and the University of Missouri, our home state, was one of the real pioneers technique.
Now, hold up a second, John. It's interesting because we have a good friend.
Oh,
have a good friend who lives close to Pittsburgh, John Jamison. He and his wife Suki own a lamb farm.
I don't think
it's every single day, but they adopted they called it a French technique for rotating their sheep very frequently from paddock to paddock and recognizing what particular grasses were in each space. So what you're talking about isn't entirely new, but I guess it's the first time that people have tried to harness it into raising beef. And now I want to go on, however, because we ran a test. You were kind enough to send us a piece of skirt steak, and instead of doing what I normally would have done, which is a variety of different things to fix it, punch it with a Jacquard machine and to coat it with things that would break down the fiber from the outside, I said, we're going to just have this with a little bit of salt and pepper added when I fry it in the black iron pan. That's all, because I want to find out what it really tastes like. And it tastes wonderful. Tastes like the best beef we ever tasted. And that's what you were saying earlier on, you discovered back with your friends in the late 1990s.
That's correct, and we were shocked, and we were, you know, and the skirt steak is really that's the true acid test of all. I mean, you can, you know, that New York strip is going to taste, but if you can make that skirt taste come through with that type of flavor, that's a true testament right there. I mean, that's one of the more challenging, you know, pieces of meat to prepare because, you know, it's just it's got a little bit of gristle in it, and it's got quite a bit of fat in it, which is where part of the flavor is coming from.
Yeah.
But this paddock business, it doesn't have to necessarily be, I just use 30 or 31. It's kind of a simple number thinking of the calendar. But what happens with this technique, it's quite fascinating. Think about the grass plants for a minute. You know, they only see animals once every 30 days or once every 45 days. And the rest period between grazing is critical to the plants because they're not being nipped off. They're able to catch solar energy. They're really a solar cell receptor, and they're able to put a deeper root system in place, and the deeper the roots go, the more minerals they bring to the surface, the more water they take down because of that translocation of the root system. And after you do this for 3 or 4 years, you not only double, but you triple your grazing capacity. Your, you know, droughts aren't near as long-lived, and you survive much longer into drought than your neighbors. And so all of a sudden, this whole business of plant community, plant diversity, it just explodes, and then these animals are the beneficiaries, and they perform better, and that's the huge difference between what's going on now and what went on, you know, back in the 1950s.
But now, why isn't everybody doing it? If it's so much better, why isn't everybody doing it?
That's a perfect, good question. I've got a friend in northeastern New Mexico who figured this out. The Roger Bell Ranch, they figured this out probably in 1975. They've been at it for almost 30 years now. And he grew up in northeast Missouri, married a lady from that part of the country, and one of our founding members has known him for his entire life. He was down there about 7 or 8 years ago with a camera, and this is a large dry land ranch, and they have practiced this management technique now for over 20 years. It's just like an oasis. I mean, their property is green, the neighbors are brown, the neighbors still laugh at him for this funny business of moving these animals around. And the springs came back where the Indians used to camp 200 years ago. They wondered why the Indians had camps, because there were no springs, there was no sources of water. Well, after you change the landscape and improve the ability for the land to absorb water, all of a sudden it all comes back. And it's a fascinating story. Humans are really strange creatures. You can show them the obvious, and they'll continue to not want to believe it. And I think...
Well, but, John, there's also another side to this, which I think is called bottom-line money, right? I mean, it's cheaper to raise these factory-farmed animals and sell them off faster and load them with antibiotics so they don't get sick, which they normally do because they're not designed to eat grain. Isn't that... a bottom-line issue, money?
It's part of it. It's part of its habit. If they really thought they could make a lot more money with grass-based agriculture, you know, they would come across that threshold quicker. But people are creatures of habit. Animals are creatures of habit. Business people are creatures of habit. And that's why I just find it amazing that we've only got 4% of the public right now today, maybe 5%, that when we go to trade shows, we did the Weston A. Price Convention this weekend in Chicago, which I think is probably the savviest group on the planet as far as... The Weston A. Price, WestonAPrice.org. And Dr. Price died in the 1950s, but he wrote a book in the 1940s. He traveled. He was a dentist, a very well-known dentist in New York. He traveled all seven continents by boat back in the 1930s, if you can imagine that. And then the war's going on around the world, but he studied peoples from all different climates and places in the world, and he looked at their teeth, and he made the correlation between their teeth and their diet. And so, anyway, this business of having a high-fat diet, high-protein diet with a lot of organ meats is really the key to health. And every time we do this once a year, the Weston Price people are lean and lithe. Their skin color is outstanding. They eat a stupid amount of meat. They eat a stupid amount of fat. And, you know, they're all the better for it. And it's, but when you talk to them, they've all had some reason, some health scare, whatever, you know, or wanted to lose weight. But our challenge has been, and then part of the conception has been, and I like the fact that you're part of your business is cooking, you know, as people have a conception that grass-fed beef is not going to taste well, and or it's going to be tough and chewy. And if you manage the animals properly and do the things that we think are necessary, you'll have a very tender steak, you'll have a very highly flavorful steak. And I go to the fancy restaurants today, and my comment to the maitre d' would be, well, the steak was tender, but it was very, very bland in flavor, and he looked at you really funny. I said, well, I raise grass-fed beef, and our steaks have much better flavor than yours.
And listeners, from the experience we had, we would entirely agree. I think the last thing we need to do before we sign off here is to get John to tell us how you get some.
Yeah, I want to know what uswellnessmeats.com is.
U.S. Wellness Meats, this was a website that we founded back in 2000, and it started out as strictly a grass-fed beef company. And then we ran into an outstanding group of producers in southeastern Minnesota that make some of the best butter in the country off of grass-fed cows. And we've added grass-fed butter. They've won the American Cheese Society contest 2 out of the last 5 years. And then we added a free-range poultry company out of South Carolina, the owner of which was the president of the South Carolina Organic Association, been raising free-range chickens for 30 years. So we've slowly added butter and cheese and free-range chickens, and we've added lamb. We've added gourmet rabbits.
I've been on this website, and, I mean, the choices are just so enormous. I mean, we've only just sort of waded into the beef, but all the others seem to be extremely promising as well.
So what's the website, John?
The website is very simple, uswellnessmeats.com, uswellnessmeats, as in plural, .com. And we have a toll-free number for your listeners that do not have the Internet capability. It's 877-383-0051. Again, 877-383-0051.
And there's information on the site, listeners, that helps educate you about what you're getting, too. Correct, John?
That is correct. We spent a lot of time with education, and the website's got all sorts of links in there as to, explains what we've talked about today, the difference between grass-fed and grain-fed, and talks about the CLA. And we have an omega-6-3 ratio in these animals of 2 to 1 compared to 20 to 1 with grain-fed beef. And it's a tremendous difference as far as your aches and pains. Omega-3s are anti-inflammatory.
So John Wood is not just a cattleman. I think we would also call him a beef counter-revolutionary.
And he's not shy.
and we are so delighted that you joined us on the menu today, John.
I'm honored to be a part of your program, and I'm certainly thrilled by your willingness to help educate further the cause of grass-fed beef in the U.S. and the world.
Oh, I'm right there with you. We love it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Bye-bye.
Have a great day.
Well, there you have it. I don't know which side of this issue you come down on, but I'm sure that you know a whole lot more about it now. What do you think, sweetheart?
Well, yes. And then I guess we get to vote.
Do we get to vote? Well,
yeah.
You can vote if you like. Let us know what you think. Whether you're a grass feeder or a corn feeder or a marbler or an unmarbler or an omega-6 or an omega-3 or whatever we might be talking about here. But that's enough from us for another week. We'll see you again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.